T.S. Eliot. You are absolutely correct, of course, when you say that we can't go on asking for more money from the president unless we demonstrate progress. Frank Rauscher, director of the National Cancer Program, to Mary Lasker, 1974. In God we trust. All others must have data. In science, ideology tends to corrupt. Absolute ideology corrupts absolutely. Robert Nisbet. Orthodoxy in surgery is like orthodoxy in other departments of the mind. It begins to almost challenge a comparison with religion. Jeffrey Keynes. You mean I had a mastectomy for nothing? Rose Kushner. Farber was fortunate to have lived in the right time, but he was perhaps even more fortunate to have died at the right time. The year of his death, 1973, marked the beginning of a deeply fractured and contentious period in the history of cancer. Theories were shattered, drug discoveries stagnated, trials languished, and academic meetings degenerated into all-out brawls. Radiotherapists, chemotherapists, and surgeons fought viciously for power and information. The war on cancer seemed, at times, to have devolved into a war within cancer. The unraveling began at the very center of oncology. Radical surgery, Halsted's cherished legacy, had undergone an astonishing boom in the 1950s and 60s. At surgical conferences around the world, Halsted's descendants, powerful and outspoken surgeons such as Cushman Hagenson and Jerome Urban, had stood up to announce that they had outdone the master himself in their radicalism. In my own surgical attack on carcinoma of the breast, Hagenson wrote in 1956, I have followed the fundamental principle that the disease, even in its early stage, is such a formidable enemy that it is my duty to carry out as radical an operation as the anatomy permits. The radical mastectomy had thus edged into the super-radical and then into the ultra-radical, an extraordinarily morbid, disfiguring procedure in which surgeons removed the breast, the pectoral muscles, the axillary nodes, the chest wall, and occasionally the ribs, parts of the sternum, the clavicle, and the lymph nodes inside the chest. Halsted, meanwhile, had become the patron saint of cancer surgery, a deity presiding over his comprehensive theory of cancer. He had called it, with his Shakespearean ear for phrase-making, the centrifugal theory, the idea that cancer, like a malevolent pinwheel, tended to spread in ever-growing arcs from a single central focus in the body. Breast cancer, he claimed, spun out from the breast into the lymph nodes under the arm. Poetically again, he called these nodes sentinels, then cartwheeled mirthlessly through the blood into the liver, lungs, and bones. A surgeon's job was to arrest that centrifugal spread by cutting every piece of it out of the body, as if to catch and break the wheel in mid-spin. This meant treating early breast cancer aggressively and definitively. The more a surgeon cut, the more he cured. Even for patients, that manic diligence had become a form of therapy. Women wrote to their surgeons in admiration and awe, begging them not to spare their surgical extirpations, as if surgery were an anagogical ritual that would simultaneously rid them of cancer and uplift them into health. Hagenson transformed from surgeon to shaman. To some extent, he wrote about his patients, no doubt they transfer the burden of their disease to me. Another surgeon wrote, chillingly, that he sometimes operated on cancer of the breast solely for its effect on morale. He also privately noted, I do not despair of carcinoma being cured somewhere in the future, but this blessed achievement will, I believe, never be wrought by the knife of the surgeon. Halsted may have converted an entire generation of physicians in America to believe in the blessed achievement of his surgical knife. But the farther one got from Baltimore, the less, it seemed, was the force of his centrifugal theory. At St. Bartholomew's Hospital in London, a young doctor named Geoffrey Keynes was not so convinced. In August 1924, Keynes examined a patient with breast cancer, a thin, emaciated woman of 47 with an ulcerated malignant lump in her breast. In Baltimore or in New York, such a patient would immediately have been whisked off for radical surgery. But Keynes was concerned about his patient's constitutional frailty. Rather than reaching indiscriminately for a radical procedure, which would likely have killed her at the operating table, he opted for a much more conservative strategy. Noting that radiation therapists, such as Emil Grube, had demonstrated the efficacy of X-rays in treating breast cancer, Keynes buried 50 milligrams of radium in her breast to irradiate her tumor and monitored her to observe the effect, hoping at best to palliate her symptoms. Surprisingly, he found a marked improvement. "The ulcer rapidly healed," he wrote, "and the whole mass became smaller, softer, and less fixed." Her mass reduced so rapidly, Keynes thought he might be able to perform a rather minimal, non-radical surgery on her to completely remove it. Emboldened by his success, between 1924 and 1928, Keynes attempted other variations on the same strategy. The most successful of these permutations, he found, involved a careful mixture of surgery and radiation, both at relatively small doses. He removed the malignant lumps locally with a minor operation, i.e., without resorting to radical or ultra-radical surgery. He followed the surgery with radiation to the breast. There was no stripping of nodes, no cracking or excavation of clavicles, no extirpations that stretched into 6 or 8 hours. Nothing was radical, yet in case after case, Keynes and his colleagues found that their cancer recurrence rate was at least comparable to those obtained in New York or Baltimore, achieved without grinding patients through the terrifying crucible of radical surgery. In 1927, in a rather technical report to his department, Keynes reviewed his experience combining local surgery with radiation. "For some cases of breast cancer," he wrote, with characteristic understatement, "the extension of the operation beyond a local removal might sometimes be unnecessary." Everything about Keynes' sentence was carefully, strategically, almost surgically constructed. Its implication was enormous. If local surgery resulted in the same outcome as radical surgery, then the centrifugal theory had to be reconsidered. Keynes had slyly declared war on radical surgery, even if he had done so by pricking it with a pin-size lancet. But Halsted's followers in America laughed away Keynes's efforts. They retaliated by giving his operation a nickname, the lumpectomy. The name was like a low-minded joke, a cartoon surgery in which a white-coated doctor pulls out a body part and calls it a lump. Keynes' theory and operation were largely ignored by American surgeons. He gained fame briefly in Europe as a pioneer of blood transfusions during the First World War, but his challenge to radical surgery was quietly buried. Keynes would have remained conveniently forgotten by American surgeons except for a fateful series of events. In 1953, a colleague of Keynes, on sabbatical from St. Bart's at the Cleveland Clinic in Ohio, gave a lecture on the history of breast cancer, focusing on Keynes' observations on minimal surgery for the breast. In the audience that evening was a young surgeon named George Barney Crile. Crile and Keynes had never met, but they shared old intellectual debts. Crile's father, George Crile Sr., had pioneered the use of blood transfusions in America and written a widely read textbook on the subject. During the First World War, Keynes had learned to transfuse blood in sterilized cone-shaped glass vessels, an apparatus devised in part by the elder Dr. Crile. "Political revolutions," the writer Amitav Ghosh writes, "often occur in the courtyards of palaces, in spaces on the cusp of power, located neither outside nor inside. Scientific revolutions, in contrast, typically occur in basements, in buried-away places removed from mainstream corridors of thought. But a surgical revolution must emanate from within surgery's inner sanctum, for surgery is a profession intrinsically sealed to outsiders. To even enter the operating theater, one must be soused in soap and water and surgical tradition. To change surgery, one must be a surgeon. The Kryls, father and son, were quintessential surgical insiders. The elder Kryl, an early proponent of radical surgery, was a contemporary of Halstead's. The younger had learned the radical mastectomy from students of Halstead himself. The Kryls were steeped in Halsteadian tradition, upholding the very pole staffs of radical surgery for generations. But like Keynes in London, Kryl Jr. was beginning to have his own doubts about the radical mastectomy. Animal studies performed in mice, by Skipper in Alabama, among others, had revealed that tumors implanted in animals did not behave as Halstead might have imagined. When a large tumor was grown in one site, microscopic metastatic deposits from it often skipped over the local nodes and appeared in faraway places, such as the liver and the spleen. Cancer didn't move centrifugally by whirling through larger and larger ordered spirals. Its spread was more erratic and unpredictable. As Kryl poured through Keynes's data, the old patterns suddenly began to make sense. Hadn't Halstead also observed that patients had died 4 or 5 years after radical surgery from occult metastasis? Could breast cancer in these patients also have metastasized to faraway organs even before radical surgery? The flaw in the logic began to crystallize. If the tumor was locally confined to start with, Kryl argued, then it would be adequately removed by local surgery and radiation. And manically stripping away extra nodes and muscles could add no possible benefit. In contrast, if breast cancer had already spread outside the breast, then surgery would be useless anyway, and more aggressive surgery would simply be more aggressively useless. Breast cancer, Kryl realized, was either an inherently localized disease, thus curable by a smaller mastectomy, or an inherently systemic disease, thus incurable even by the most exhaustive surgery. Kryl soon gave up on the radical mastectomy altogether, and instead began to operate in a manner similar to Keynes's, using a limited surgical approach. Kryl called it the simple mastectomy. Over about 6 years, he found that his simple operation was remarkably similar to Keynes's lumpectomy plus radiation combination in its impact. The survival rate of patients treated with either form of local surgery tended to be no different from that of those treated historically with the radical mastectomy. Separated by an ocean and 40 years of clinical practice, both Keynes and Kryl had seemingly stumbled on the same clinical truth. But was it a truth? Keynes had no means to prove it. Until the 1930s, clinical trials had typically been designed to prove positive results. Treatment A was better than treatment B, or drug X superior to drug Y. But to prove a negative result, that radical surgery was no better than conventional surgery, one needed a new set of statistical measures. The invention of that measure would have a profound influence on the history of oncology, a branch of medicine particularly suffused with hope, and thus particularly prone to unsubstantiated claims of success. In 1928, 4 years after Keynes had begun his lumpectomies in London, two statisticians, Jerzy Nyman and Egon Pearson, provided a systematic method to evaluate a negative statistical claim. To measure the confidence in a negative claim, Nyman and Pearson invoked a statistical concept called power. Power, in simplistic terms, is a measure of the ability of a test or trial to reject a hypothesis. Intuitively, Nyman and Pearson reasoned that a scientist's capacity to reject a hypothesis depends most critically on how intensively he has tested the hypothesis, and thus on the number of samples that have independently been tested. If one compares five radical mastectomies against five conventional mastectomies and finds no difference in outcome, it is hard to make a significant conclusion about the result. But if 1,000 cases of each produce precisely identical outcomes, then one can make a strong claim about a lack of benefit. Right there, buried inside that dependence, lies one of the strangest pitfalls of medicine. For any trial to be adequately powered, it needs to recruit an adequate number of patients. But to recruit patients, a trialist has to convince doctors to participate in the trial, and yet these doctors are often precisely those who have the least interest in having a theory rejected or disproved. For breast cancer, a discipline immersed in the legacy of the radical surgery, these conflicts were particularly charged. No breast cancer trial, for instance, could have proceeded without the explicit blessing and participation of larger-than-life surgeons such as Hogginson and Irvin. Yet these surgeons, all enraptured intellectual descendants of Halsted, were the least likely to sponsor a trial that might dispute the theory that they had so passionately advocated for decades. When critics wondered whether Hogginson had been biased in his evaluation by selecting only his best cases, he challenged surgeons to replicate his astounding success using their own alternative methods. Go thou and do likewise. Thus, even Kreil, a full 40 years after Keynes's discovery, couldn't run a trial to dispute Halsted's mastectomy. The hierarchical practice of medicine, its internal culture, its rituals of practice, the gospels of the surgical profession, as Kreil mockingly called it, were ideally arranged to resist change and to perpetuate orthodoxy. Kreil found himself pitted against his own department, against friends and colleagues. The very doctors that he would need to recruit to run such a trial were fervently, often viciously, opposed to it. Power in the colloquial sense of the word thus collided with power in the statistical sense. The surgeons who had so painstakingly created the world of radical surgery had absolutely no incentive to revolutionize it. It took a Philadelphia surgeon named Bernard Fisher to cut through that knot of surgical tradition. Fisher was brackish, ambitious, dogged, and feisty, a man built after Halsted's image. He had trained at the University of Pittsburgh, a place just as steeped in the glorious Halstedian tradition of radical surgery as the hospitals of New York and Baltimore. But he came from a younger generation of surgeons, a generation with enough critical distance from Halsted to be able to challenge the discipline without undermining its own sense of credibility. Like Kreil and Keynes, he too had lost faith in the centrifugal theory of cancer. The more he revisited Keynes's and Kreil's data, the more Fisher was convinced that radical mastectomy had no basis in biological reality. The truth, he suspected, was quite the opposite. It has become apparent that the tangled web of threads on the wrong side of the tapestry really represented a beautiful design when examined properly, a meaningful pattern, a hypothesis diametrically opposite to those considered to be Halsteadian, Fisher wrote. The only way to turn the upside-down tapestry of Halsteadian theory around was to run a controlled clinical trial to test the radical mastectomy against the simple mastectomy and lumpectomy plus radiation. But Fisher also knew that resistance would be fierce to any such trial. Holed away in their operating rooms, their slip-covered feet dug into the very roots of radical surgery, most academic surgeons were least likely to cooperate. But another person in that operating room was stirring awake, the long-silent, etherized body lying at the far end of the scalpel, the cancer patient. By the late 1960s, the relationship between doctors and patients had begun to shift dramatically. Medicine, once considered virtually infallible in its judgment, was turning out to have deep fallibilities, flaws that appeared to cluster pointedly around issues of women's health. Thalidomide, prescribed widely to control pregnancy-associated hysteria and anxiety, was hastily withdrawn from the market in 1961 because of its propensity to cause severe fetal malformations. In Texas, Jane Roe, a pseudonym, sued the state for blocking her ability to abort her fetus at a medical clinic, launching the Roe v. Wade case on abortion and highlighting the complex nexus between the state, medical authority, and women's bodies. Political feminism, in short, was birthing medical feminism. And the fact that one of the most common and most disfiguring operations performed on women's bodies had never been formally tested in a trial stood out as even more starkly disturbing to a new generation of women. "Refuse to submit to a radical mastectomy," Kreil exhorted his patients in 1973. And refuse they did. Rachel Carson, the author of Silent Spring, and a close friend of Kreil's, refused a radical mastectomy. In retrospect, she was right. Her cancer had already spread to her bones, and radical surgery would have been pointless. Betty Rollin and Rose Kushner also refused, and soon joined Carson in challenging radical surgeons. Rollin and Kushner, both marvelous writers, provocative, down-to-earth, no-nonsense, witty, were particularly adept at challenging the bloated orthodoxy of surgery. They flooded newspapers and magazines with editorials and letters and appeared, often uninvited, at medical and surgical conferences, where they fearlessly heckled surgeons about their data and the fact that the radical mastectomy had never been put to a test. "Happily for women," Kushner wrote, "surgical custom is changing." It was as if the young woman in Halstead's famous etching, the patient that he had been so loath to disfigure, had woken up from her gurney and begun to ask why, despite his loathing, the cancer surgeon was so keen to disfigure her. In 1967, bolstered by the activism of patients and the public attention swirling around breast cancer, Fisher became the new chair of the National Surgical Adjuvant Breast and Bowel Project, NSABP, a consortium of academic hospitals modeled self-consciously after Zubrod's leukemia group that would run large-scale trials in breast cancer. 4 years later, the NSABP proposed to test the operation using a systematic, randomized trial. It was, coincidentally, the 80th anniversary of Halstead's original description of the radical mastectomy. The implicit, nearly devotional faith in a theory of cancer was finally to be put to a test. The clinician, no matter how venerable, must accept the fact that experience, voluminous as it might be, cannot be employed as a sensitive indicator of scientific validity, Fisher wrote in an article. He was willing to have faith in divine wisdom, but not in Halstead as divine wisdom. "In God we trust," he brusquely told the journalist. "All others must have data." It took Fisher a full 10 years to actually gather that data. Recruiting patients for his study was an uphill task. To get a woman to participate in a clinical trial where she was going to have her breast off or have her breast not taken off, that was a pretty difficult thing to do. Not like testing drug A versus drug B, he recalled. If patients were reluctant, surgeons were almost impossibly so. Immersed in the traditions of radical surgery, many American surgeons put up such formidable barriers to patient recruitment that Canadian surgeons and their patients were added to complete the study. The trial recruited 1,765 patients in 34 centers in the United States and Canada. Patients were randomized into three groups: one treated with the radical mastectomy, the second with simple mastectomy, and the third with surgery followed by radiation. Even with all forces in gear, it still took years to recruit adequate numbers. Crippled by forces within surgery itself, the NSABP-04 trial barely hobbled to its end. In 1981, the results of the trial were finally made public. The rates of breast cancer recurrence, relapse, death, and distant cancer metastasis were statistically identical among all three groups. The group treated with the radical mastectomy had paid heavily in morbidity, but accrued no benefits in survival, recurrence, or mortality. Between 1891 and 1981, in the nearly 100 years of the radical mastectomy, an estimated 500,000 women underwent the procedure to extirpate cancer. Many chose the procedure. Many were forced into it. Many others did not even realize that it was a choice. Many were permanently disfigured. Many perceived the surgery as a benediction. Many suffered its punishing penalties bravely, hoping that they had treated their cancer as aggressively and as definitively as possible. Halsted's Cancer Storehouse grew far beyond its original walls at Hopkins. His ideas entered oncology, then permeated its vocabulary, then its psychology, its ethos, and its self-image. When radical surgery fell, an entire culture of surgery thus collapsed with it. The radical mastectomy is rarely, if ever, performed by surgeons today. The Smiling Oncologist. Few doctors in this country seem to be involved with the non-life-threatening side effects of cancer therapy. In the United States, baldness, nausea and vomiting, diarrhea, clogged veins, financial problems, broken marriages, disturbed children, loss of libido, loss of self-esteem, and body image are nurses' turf. Rose Kushner. And it is solely by risking life that freedom is obtained. Hegel. The ominous toppling of radical surgery off its pedestal may have given cancer chemotherapists some pause for reckoning, but they had their own fantasy of radicalism to fulfill, their own radical arsenal to launch against cancer. Surgery, the traditional battle axe against cancer, was considered too primitive, too indiscriminate, and too weary. A large-scale chemotherapeutic attack, as one doctor put it, was needed to obliterate cancer. Every battle needs its iconic battleground, and if one physical place epitomized the cancer wars of the late 1970s, it was the chemotherapy ward. It was our trench and our bunker, a chemotherapist recalls, a space marked indelibly in the history of cancer. To enter the ward was to acquire automatic citizenship, as Susan Sontag might have put it, into the kingdom of the ill. The journalist Stuart Alsop was confined to one such ward at the NIH in 1973 for the treatment of a rare and unidentifiable blood cancer. Crossing its threshold, he encountered a sanitized vision of hell. Wandering about the NIH Clinical Center, in the corridors or in the elevator, one comes occasionally on a human monster, on a living nightmare, on a face or body hideously deformed, he wrote. Patients, even disguised in civilian clothes, could still be identified by the orange tinge that the chemotherapy left on their skin, underneath which lurked the unique pallor of cancer-related anemia. The space was limbo-like, with no simple means of egress, no exit. In the glass-paneled sanatorium where patients walked for leisure, Alsop recalled, the windows were covered in heavy wire mesh to prevent the men and women confined in the wards from jumping off the banisters and committing suicide. A collective amnesia prevailed in these wards. If remembering was an essential requisite for survival, then so was forgetting. Although this was a cancer ward, an anthropologist wrote, the word cancer was actively avoided by staff and patients. Patients lived by the regulations, accepted roles, a predetermined routine, constant stimuli. The artifice of manufactured cheer, a requirement for soldiers in battle, made the wards even more poignantly desolate. In one wing, where a woman lay dying from breast cancer, there were yellow and orange walls in the corridors, beige and white stripes in the patients' rooms. At the NIH, in an attempt to inject optimism into the wards, the nurses wore uniforms with plastic yellow buttons with the cartoonish outline of a smiling face. These wards created not just a psychological isolation chamber, but also a psychological microenvironment, a sterile bubble where the core theory of cancer chemotherapy, eradicating cancer with a death-defying bombardment of drugs, could be adequately tested. It was, undeniably, an experiment. At the NIH, Alsup wrote pointedly, "Saving the individual patient is not the essential mission. Enormous efforts are made to do so, or at least to prolong the patient's life to the last possible moment. But the basic purpose is not to save that patient's particular life, but to find means of saving the lives of others." In some cases, the experiment worked. In 1976, the year that the NSABP-04 trial struggled to its midpoint, a novel drug, cisplatin, appeared in the cancer wards. Cisplatin, short for cisplatinum, was a new drug forged out of an old one. Its molecular structure, a central planar platinum atom with four arms extending outward, had been described back in the 1890s. But chemists had never found an application for cisplatin. The beautiful, satisfyingly symmetric chemical structure had no obvious human use. It had been shelved away in the laboratory in relative obscurity. No one had bothered to test its biological effects. In 1965, at Michigan State University, a biophysicist, Barnett Rosenberg, began to investigate whether electrical currents might stimulate bacterial cell division. Rosenberg devised a bacterial flask through which an electrical current could be run using two platinum electrodes. When Rosenberg turned the electricity on, he found, astonishingly, that the bacterial cells stopped dividing entirely. Rosenberg initially proposed that the electrical current was the active agent in inhibiting cell division. But the electricity, he soon determined, was merely a bystander. The platinum electrode had reacted with the salt in the bacterial solution to generate a new growth-arresting molecule that had diffused throughout the liquid. That chemical was cisplatin. Like all cells, bacteria needs to replicate DNA in order to divide. Cisplatin had chemically attacked DNA with its reactive molecular arms, cross-linking and damaging the molecule irreparably, forcing cells to arrest their division. For patients such as John Cleland, cisplatin came to epitomize the new breed of aggressive chemotherapeutics of the 1970s. In 1973, Cleland was a 22-year-old veterinary student in Indiana. In August that year, 2 months after his marriage, he discovered a rapidly expanding lump in his right testis. He saw a urologist on a Tuesday afternoon in November. On Thursday, he was whisked off to the operating room for surgery. He returned with a scar that extended from his abdomen to his breastbone. The diagnosis was metastatic testicular cancer. Cancer of the testes that had migrated diffusely into his lymph nodes and lungs. In 1973, the survival rate from metastatic testes cancer was less than 5%. Cleland entered the cancer ward at Indiana University and began treatment with a young oncologist named Larry Einhorn. The regimen, a weather-beaten and toxic three-drug cocktail called ABO that had been derived from the NCI studies in the 1960s, was only marginally effective. Cleland lived in and out of the hospital. His weight shrank from 158 to 106 pounds. One day in 1974, while he was still receiving chemo, his wife suggested that they sit outside to enjoy the afternoon. Cleland realized, to his utter shame, that he was too weak to stand up. He was carried to his bed like a baby, weeping with embarrassment. In the fall of 1974, the ABO regimen was stopped. He was switched to another equally ineffective drug. Einhorn suggested a last-ditch effort, a new chemical called cisplatin. Other researchers had seen some responses in patients with testicular cancer treated with single-agent cisplatin, although not durable ones. Einhorn wanted to combine cisplatin with two other drugs to see if he could increase the response rate. There was the uncertainty of a new combination and the certainty of death. On October 7, 1974, Cleland took the gamble. He enrolled as Patient Zero for BVP, the acronym for a new regimen containing bleomycin, vinblastine, and cisplatin, abbreviated P for platinum. 10 days later, when he returned for his routine scans, the tumors in his lungs had vanished. Ecstatic and mystified, he called his wife from a hospital phone. "I cannot remember what I said, but I told her." Cleland's experience was typical. By 1975, Einhorn had treated 20 additional patients with the regimen and found dramatic and sustained responses virtually unheard of in the history of this disease. Einhorn presented his data at the annual meeting of oncologists held in Toronto in the winter of 1975. "Walking up to that podium was like my own walk on the moon," he recalled. By the late winter of 1976, it was becoming progressively clearer that some of these patients would not relapse at all. Einhorn had cured a solid cancer by chemotherapy. "It was unforgettable. In my own naive mind, I thought this was the formula that we had been missing all the while." Cisplatin was unforgettable in more than one sense. The drug provoked an unremitting nausea, a queasiness of such penetrating force and quality that had rarely been encountered in the history of medicine. On average, patients treated with the drug vomited 12 times a day. In the 1970s, there were very few effective anti-nausea drugs. Most patients had to be given intravenous fluids to tide them through the nausea. Some survived by smuggling marijuana, a mild antiemetic, into the chemotherapy wards. In Margaret Edson's play, Wit, a scathing depiction of a woman's battle with ovarian cancer, an English professor undergoing chemotherapy clutches a nausea basin on the floor of her hospital ward, dry heaving in guttural agony, prompting her unforgettable aside, "You may think my vocabulary has taken a turn for the Anglo-Saxon." The pharmacological culprit lurking unmentioned behind that scene is cisplatin. Even today, nurses on oncology floors who tended to patients in the early 1980s, before the advent of newer antiemetics that would somewhat ease the effect of the drug, can vividly recall the violent jolts of nausea that suddenly descended on patients and brought them dry heaving to the ground. In nursing slang, the drug came to be known as cisplatin. These side effects, however revolting, were considered minor dues to pay for an otherwise miraculous drug. Cisplatin was touted as the epic chemotherapeutic product of the late 1970s, the quintessential example of how curing cancer involved pushing patients nearly to the brink of death. By 1978, cisplatin-based chemotherapy was the new vogue in cancer pharmacology. Every conceivable combination was being tested on thousands of patients across America. The lemon-yellow chemical dripping through intravenous lines was as ubiquitous in the cancer wards as the patients clutching their nausea basins afterward. The NCI, meanwhile, was turning into a factory of toxins. The influx of money from the National Cancer Act had potently stimulated the Institute's drug discovery program, which had grown into an even more gargantuan effort and was testing hundreds of thousands of chemicals each year to discover new cytotoxic drugs. The strategy of discovery was empirical, throwing chemicals at cancer cells in test tubes to identify cancer killers. But by now, unabashedly and defiantly so. The biology of cancer was still poorly understood. But the notion that even relatively indiscriminate cytotoxic agents discovered largely by accident would cure cancer had captivated oncology. We want and need and seek better guidance, and are gaining it. Howard Skipper, Fry and Freyreich's collaborator on the early leukemia studies, admitted in 1971. But we cannot afford to sit and wait for the promise of tomorrow so long as stepwise progress can be made with tools at hand today. Ehrlich's seductive phrase, magic bullet, had seemingly been foreshortened. What this war needed was simply bullets, whether magical or not, to annihilate cancer. Chemicals thus came pouring out of the NCI's cauldrons, each one with a unique personality. There was Taxol, 1 gram purified from the bark of 100 Pacific yew trees, whose molecular structure resembled a winged insect. Adriamycin, discovered in 1969, was blood red. It was the chemical responsible for the orange-red tinge that Alsop had seen at the NCI's cancer ward. Even at therapeutic doses, it could irreversibly damage the heart. Etoposide came from the fruit of the poisonous mayapple. Bleomycin, which could scar lungs without warning, was an antibiotic derived from a mold. Did we believe we were going to cure cancer with these chemicals? George Kanellis recalled. Absolutely, we did. The NCI was a charged place. The chief, Zubrod, wanted the boys to move into solid tumors. I proposed ovarian cancer. Others proposed breast cancer. We wanted to get started on the larger clinical problems. We spoke of curing cancer as if it was almost a given. In the mid-1970s, high-dose combination chemotherapy scored another sentinel victory. Burkitt's lymphoma, the tumor originally discovered in southern Africa and rarely found in children and adolescents in America and Europe, was cured with a cocktail of 7 drugs, including a molecular cousin of nitrogen mustard, a regimen concocted at the NCI by Ian McGrath and John Ziegler. Many of these NCI-sponsored trials were carried out in Uganda, where Burkitt's lymphoma is endemic in children. The felling of yet another aggressive tumor by combination chemotherapy even more potently boosted the Institute's confidence, once again underscoring the likelihood that the generic solution to cancer had been found. Events outside the world of medicine also impinged on oncology, injecting new blood and verve into the Institute. In the early 1970s, young doctors who opposed the Vietnam War flooded to the NCI. Due to an obscure legal clause, enrollment in a federal research program such as the NIH exempted someone from the draft. The undrafted soldiers of one battle were thus channeled into another. Our applications skyrocketed. They were brilliant and energetic, these new fellows at the Institute, Kanellis said. They wanted to run new trials, to test new permutations of drugs. We were a charged place. At the NCI and in its academic outposts around the world, the names of regimens evolved into a language of their own. ABVD, BEP, CMOP, CHLA-VIP, CHOP, ACT. There is no cancer that is not potentially curable, an ovarian cancer chemotherapist self-assuredly told the media at a conference in 1979. The chances in some cases are infinitesimal, but the potential is still there. This is about all that patients need to know. And it is about all that patients want to know. The greatly expanded coffers of the NCI also stimulated enormous, expensive, multi-institutional trials, allowing academic centers to trot out ever more powerful permutations of cytotoxic drugs. Cancer hospitals, also boosted by the NCI's grants, organized themselves into efficient and thrumming trial-running machines. By 1979, the NCI had recognized 20 so-called comprehensive cancer centers spread across the nation, hospitals with large wards dedicated exclusively to cancer, run by specialized teams of surgeons and chemotherapists, and supported by psychiatrists, pathologists, radiologists, social workers, and ancillary staff. Hospital review boards that approved and coordinated human experimentation were revamped to allow researchers to bulldoze their way through institutional delays. It was trial and error on a giant human scale, with the emphasis, it seemed at times, distinctly on error. One NCI-sponsored trial tried to outdo Einhorn by doubling the dose of cisplatin in testicular cancer. Toxicity doubled, although there was no additional therapeutic effect. In another particularly tenacious trial, known as the 8-in-1 study, children with brain tumors were given 8 drugs in a single day. Predictably, horrific complications ensued. 15% of the patients needed blood transfusions. 6% were hospitalized with life-threatening infections. 14% of the children suffered kidney damage. 3 lost their hearing. 1 patient died of septic shock. Yet despite the punishing escalation of drugs and doses, the efficacy of the drug regimen remained minimal. Most of the children in the 8-in-1 trial died soon afterward, having only marginally responded to chemotherapy. This pattern was repeated with tiresome regularity for many forms of cancer. In metastatic lung cancer, for instance, combination chemotherapy was found to increase survival by 3 or 4 months, in colon cancer, by less than 6 months, in breast, by about 12. I do not mean to belittle the impact of 12 or 13 months of survival. One extra year can carry a lifetime of meaning for a man or woman condemned to death from cancer, but it took a particularly fanatical form of zeal to refuse to recognize that this was far from a cure. Between 1984 and 1985, at the midpoint of the most aggressive expansion of chemotherapy, nearly 6,000 articles were published on the subject in medical journals. Not a single article reported a new strategy for the definitive cure of an advanced solid tumor by means of combination chemotherapy alone. Like lunatic cartographers, chemotherapists frantically drew and redrew their strategies to annihilate cancer. MOP, the combination that had proved successful in Hodgkin's disease, went through every conceivable permutation for breast, lung, and ovarian cancer. More combinations entered clinical trials, each more aggressive than its precursor, and each tagged by its own cryptic, nearly indecipherable name. Rose Kushner, by then a member of the National Cancer Advisory Board, warned against the growing disconnect between doctors and their patients. When doctors say that the side effects are tolerable or acceptable, they are talking about life-threatening things, she wrote. But if you just vomit so hard that you break the blood vessels in your eyes, they don't consider that even mentionable, and they certainly don't care if you're bald. She wrote sarcastically, "The smiling oncologist does not know whether his patients vomit or not." The language of suffering had parted, with the smiling oncologist on one side and his patients on the other. In Edson's Wit, a work not kind to the medical profession, a young oncologist, drunk with the arrogance of power, personifies the divide as he spouts out lists of nonsensical drugs and combinations while his patient, the English professor, watches with mute terror and fury. Hexamethophosphacil with vinplatin to potentiate, hex at 300 milligrams per meter squared, vin at 100. Today is cycle 2, day 3. Both cycles at the full dose. Knowing the enemy. It is said that if you know your enemies and know yourself, you will not be imperiled in 100 battles. If you do not know your enemies, but do know yourself, you will win one and lose one. If you do not know your enemies nor yourself, you will be imperiled in every single battle. Sun Tzu. As the armada of cytotoxic therapy readied itself for even more aggressive battles against cancer, a few dissenting voices began to be heard along its peripheries. These voices were connected by two common themes. First, the dissidents argue that indiscriminate chemotherapy, the unloading of barrel after barrel of poisonous drugs, could not be the only strategy by which to attack cancer. Contrary to prevailing dogma, cancer cells possessed unique and specific vulnerabilities that rendered them particularly sensitive to certain chemicals that had little impact on normal cells. Second, such chemicals could only be discovered by uncovering the deep biology of every cancer cell. Cancer-specific therapies existed, but they could only be known from the bottom up, i.e., from solving the basic biological riddles of each form of cancer, rather than from the top down, by maximizing cytotoxic chemotherapy or by discovering cellular poisons empirically. To attack a cancer cell specifically, one needed to begin by identifying its biological behavior, its genetic makeup, and its unique vulnerabilities. The search for magic bullets needed to begin with an understanding of cancer's magical targets. The most powerful such voice arose from the most unlikely of sources, a urological surgeon, Charles Huggins, who was neither a cell biologist nor even a cancer biologist, but rather a physiologist interested in glandular secretions. Born in Nova Scotia in 1901, Huggins attended Harvard Medical School in the early 1920s, where he intersected briefly with Farber, and trained as a general surgeon in Michigan. In 1927, at age 26, he was appointed to the faculty of the University of Chicago as a urological surgeon, a specialist in diseases of the bladder, kidney, genitals, and prostate. Huggins's appointment epitomized the confidence and hubris of surgery. He possessed no formal training in urology, nor had he trained as a cancer surgeon. It was an era when surgical specialization was still a fluid concept. If a man could remove an appendix or a lymph node, the philosophy ran, he could certainly learn to remove a kidney. Huggins thus learned urology on the fly by cramming a textbook in about 6 weeks. He arrived optimistically in Chicago, expecting to find a busy, flourishing practice. But his new clinic, housed inside a stony neo-Gothic tower, remained empty all winter. The fluidity of surgical specialization was, perhaps, not as reassuring to patients. Tired of memorizing books and journals in an empty, drafty waiting room, Huggins changed tracks and set up a laboratory to study urological diseases while waiting for patients to come to his clinic. To choose a medical specialty is also to choose its cardinal bodily liquid. Hematologists have blood. Hepatologists have bile. Huggins had prostatic fluid, a runny, straw-colored mixture of salt and sugar meant to lubricate and nourish sperm. Its source, the prostate, is a small gland buried deep in the perineum, wrapped around the outlet of the urinary tract in men. Vesalius was the first to identify it and draw it into human anatomy. Walnut-shaped and only walnut-sized, it is yet ferociously the site of cancer. Prostate cancer represents a full third of all cancer incidents in men, sixfold that of leukemia and lymphoma. In autopsies of men over 60 years old, nearly one in every three specimens will bear some evidence of prostatic malignancy. But although an astoundingly common form of cancer, prostate cancer is also highly variable in its clinical course. Most cases are indolent, elderly men usually die with prostate cancer than die of prostate cancer. But in other patients, the disease can be aggressive and invasive, capable of exploding into painful lesions in the bones and lymph nodes in its advanced metastatic form. Huggins, though, was far less interested in cancer than in the physiology of prostatic fluid. Female hormones, such as estrogen, were known to control the growth of breast tissue. Did male hormones, by analogy, control the growth of the normal prostate, and thus regulate the secretion of its principal product, prostatic fluid? By the late 1920s, Huggins had devised an apparatus to collect precious drops of prostatic fluid from dogs. He diverted urine away by inserting a catheter into the bladder and stitched a collection tube to the exit of the prostate gland. It was the only surgical innovation that he would devise in his lifetime. Huggins now had a tool to measure prostatic function. He could quantify the amount of fluid produced by the gland. He found that if he surgically removed the testicles of his dogs, and thereby depleted the dogs of the hormone testosterone, the prostate gland involuted and shriveled, and the fluid secretion dried up precipitously. If he injected the castrated dogs with purified testosterone, the exogenous hormone saved the prostate from shriveling. Prostate cells were thus acutely dependent on the hormone testosterone for their growth and function. Female sexual hormones kept breast cells alive. Male hormones had a similar effect on prostate cells. Huggins wanted to delve further into the metabolism of testosterone and the prostate cell, but his experiments were hampered by a peculiar problem. Dogs, humans, and lions are the only animals known to develop prostate cancer, and dogs with sizable prostate tumors kept appearing in his labs during his studies. It was vexatious to encounter a dog with a prostatic tumor during a metabolic study, he wrote. His first impulse was to cull the cancer-afflicted dogs from his study and continue single-mindedly with his fluid collection. But then a question formed in his mind. If testosterone deprivation could shrink normal prostate cells, what might testosterone deprivation do to cancer cells? The answer, as any self-respecting cancer biologist might have informed him, was almost certain. Very little. Cancer cells, after all, were deranged, uninhibited, and altered, responsive only to the most poisonous combinations of drugs. The signals and hormones that regulated normal cells had long been flung aside. What remained was a cell driven to divide with such pathological and autonomous fecundity that it had erased all memory of normalcy. But Huggins knew that certain forms of cancer did not obey this principle. Variants of thyroid cancer, for instance, continued to make thyroid hormone, the growth-stimulating molecule secreted by the normal thyroid gland. Even though cancerous, these cells remembered their former selves. Huggins found that prostate cancer cells also retained a physiological memory of their origin. When he removed the testicles of prostate cancer-bearing dogs, thus acutely depriving the cancer cells of testosterone, the tumors also involuted within days. In fact, if normal prostate cells were dependent on testosterone for survival, then malignant prostate cells were nearly addicted to the hormone. So much so that the acute withdrawal acted like the most powerful therapeutic drug conceivable. Cancer is not necessarily autonomous and intrinsically self-perpetuating, Huggins wrote. Its growth can be sustained and propagated by hormonal function in the host. The link between the growth sustenance of normal cells and of cancer cells was much closer than previously imagined. Cancer could be fed and nurtured by our own bodies. Surgical castration, fortunately, was not the only means to starve prostate cancer cells. If male hormones were driving the growth of these cancer cells, Huggins reasoned, then rather than eliminate the male hormones, What if one tricked the cancer into thinking that the body was female by suppressing the effect of testosterone? In 1929,